My name is Clancy Immisland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Glad to be at the famous Jarvey Pig Roast. Last night I was on a steamboat in the Mississippi. Kind of a culture shock. I know some of us were here at the Minneapolis convention last week. That was a great convention. We all enjoyed it. And it gives you a shot in the arm. For those of you who have not been or who are slightly apprehensive about going to an international convention, you ought to go. Because you sit in the room last Saturday night, I sat in the room, like most of us did, with some 50,000 people excited and up and good and feeling good. It's just great. I've been home for about 10 days. I was talking to my wife on the phone. I guess things are all right. I came in today. I had to get up at 4:30 in St. Louis this morning. I got a plane at 6 to come to Denver to come here. I got off the plane and there was a little mix-up. Not a big one, but a little mix-up. And I was on the phone cursing Larry Lawler. He had nothing to do with it, but he was convenient. But anyway, Glenn finally and I got together and we came here. He's been a very excellent host. And we have to be very kind to him because he has to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and take me back to Edmonton so I can get a plane at 8 o'clock, which was supposed to take me to Denver, then to Los Angeles, but Air Canada canceled the flight, so tomorrow we'll get 8 o'clock and fly to Chicago. They think that's on their way to Los Angeles. I got to get home tomorrow, though, because it's my birthday, and I want to see if any of my ungrateful kids have brought me things. They don't have much time left. You know, I'm getting up there, as you say. I mean, I'll be here 2 years from now. Thanks a lot for that vote of confidence. I was telling someone, you know, I'm turning 73 tomorrow, which is not a world's record for being old, but I feel great. I always feel like I'm 35. But when I was about 70, the doctors started giving me some iron tablets for my blood. I guess they're supposed to do that. And then a couple months ago, I did something which I don't know why I did. I'm reading ads about it. I tried a Viagra. And I didn't know that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now, every 4 hours, I face north. That's just a joke. I heard a guy in Minneapolis say something worse than that. He said, "I'm pretty old now." He said, I just take an eighth of a Viagra every morning. I said, "Why do you do that?" "Because so I won't pee on my shoes." We were talking on the way over here. Some of you saw that A&E special on Alcoholics Anonymous. Ran a couple weeks ago, kind of interesting. Incidentally, here's a little piece of news that's kind of sad and touching. Remember, if those of you saw it, there was a woman on there who gave the other side of the coin, saying, "Hey, it doesn't work for me." And she has a book called Moderation Management. She is in jail in Seattle at the moment because about 6 weeks ago, while drunk, she drove the wrong way down the freeway and killed a guy and his daughter in a car. So she won't be doing the other side of it. In fact, the news article on it talks about she has now decided to go to AA. So we're all sick with godness over that. But the World Service Office, called me up and asked me if I'd be willing to be interviewed for this show, and I said sure, because it's no big deal. And they came out, and there's a place called Ohio Street Meeting Hall on the west side of L.A. It's kind of a long, narrow building with a lot of windows and doors on one side, on the south side. So I sat there in front of the light, and so there's a silhouette. And they set up this camera. Because you have to maintain anonymity, which I strongly believe in. But it's the interesting thing. I get in the newspapers and television a lot because of the nature of my work in Los Angeles. I'm not an AA member, but being quoted on various things. And so I'm being seen as not a great deal to me. But I must say, when I saw that camera and I knew that film was going all over North America, I just sat there in a terrible temptation. Just had to go. fought it back, but it was. But the guy asked me two or three questions, which were interesting because they didn't. I guess my answers weren't really as complete and dramatic as he'd like. They didn't make it onto the film. But the questions were really interesting to me because, you know, they ask you questions and deal those kind of deals. They ask you questions like, well, how many members of your organization, how many chapters you have, whatever it might be. And the first question he asked me, he caught me by surprise. He said, why is it that some alcoholics seem to be able to stop drinking on their own and so many more have to go to AA? Why is that? And that's a good question, and that's absolutely true. As far as anybody can tell, there are some alcoholics who seem to be alcoholics by any test you can give them, who drink to excess, but when their security is threatened, perhaps a family problem or a death in the family or something leaves them and they lose their job or something that threatens their basic security, and they're taken aback by it says, I quit! And they never drink again. And there's also another type of alcoholic who become physically addicted as well as emotionally addicted, and they are the people for whom treatment centers were originally set up, so they could be withdrawn medically, taking off little by little, and each step of the way, they show them what alcohol is doing to their lives, to their families. Yeah, I quit! And they quit forever. And then there's another type of alcoholic, by far the most numerous, and which we are familiar with. And these type of alcoholics are people who have their security threatened, something terrible happens, they quit, but they eventually always drink again. Or people who are withdrawn medically, but eventually they always drink again. And these are the people that have baffled medicine and baffled lawyers and baffled judges and baffled doctors and baffled religious people, most of all baffled families for a long time. You know, I'm sure that most of the people in this room have had this experience, most of the alcoholics, because most of us have thought we will be able to stop if we want to. And we do stop, and we convince people we're stopped. And I always remember that look on my wife's face or other people's faces when you show up drunk again. And it's a look of, oh, how could you? You promised. You promised the children. You're going to lose your job. How could you do this after all these things that have happened? And of course, they act as though we have an answer. I never had an answer for it. Because I'm just as baffled as they are, except it makes me. It's kind of funny, except it's lethal. And I don't have any answer for it, so the answer I would use, most people use, such things you say to your wife or children or loved ones, get away from me, goddammit, leave me alone. Just leave me alone. Because I don't know the answer either, and I just can't stand the feeling of guilt. And these are the people that nobody understands why they're like that. When Bill Wilson wrote this book in 1939, he realized that there were a few people who seemed to be able to stop drinking without much else. He didn't know why, but he knew that there are other kinds of alcoholics who couldn't, thought they could. And that's why again and again in this book he refers to alcoholics of our type. He never refers to the other type, but always of our type. And that type is, as we see, we're talking about that in the truck on the way up here. There are some people, apparently, who are those people who can stop and stop, and then out of boredom after a while, they go to AA. And so they're kind of cute, except they sit around there and they tell new people it's not necessary to do these things. I didn't do it, and I'm sober. And they literally kill people. They literally can kill newcomers. Those old people that sit in AA and say, don't do these things, they should be booted as far as their shoes to work, I think. But I don't judge them. I just. But anyway, all I told the guy when he asked me these questions, all I could think of was, well, there are some small amount of people who can stop, and a large number of people who think they can stop but can't. And most of the large number, at one time or another, think they're the people who can stop, and they're just driven to discover they can. So then the next question he asked me was kind of. I guess that answer is kind of unsatisfactory. Usually I get a little further into my talk before they start peeling off. Maybe we can get up to Edmund and Early tonight. And the next question he asked me is an interesting question, too. He said, how come, why is it that, okay, these alcoholics that need help, they go to AA. Why is it that some of them stay sober at AA and some of them don't? Most of them don't. Why don't they? Why is that? And that sounds kind of strange, but that's absolutely true. If you've been sober more than 20 minutes, you know that's true. If all the people in the front row here were newcomers tonight, and they all went to AA meetings, went to the same meetings, had the same sponsor, heard the same things, read the same things. In a few weeks, a couple of them would be gone, and a couple more would be gone. Pretty soon, a couple more. Maybe at the end of the year, a couple would be here, maybe. And the ironic thing is that sometimes the ones who are here, the ones that you wouldn't think would stay here at all. The ones that you had such hopes for are gone. And how do you explain that? And he asked me how I could explain that. And I really had to think about that a little bit, because my mind had a flash on myself and to my story. So I'll tell you something. I am not what they call a masochist. I do not enjoy pain, physical or mental. I am, if anything, I prefer hedonism or more comfort. That's what I want. Now, if I hate pain, always have hated pain, why was it that I came to AA full of pain and they said there's an answer here for me? Why did I slip year after 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 year? The worst years of my life came after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous off and on. Those years, not because I was in AA, but because those were the years it was happening. And I looked like, why in the God's name would I go through all that pain? And I came as kind of a high-bottom drunk, and eventually I became kind of a medium-bottom drunk. And the last day I drank up to a lot, thank God, woke two big guys, threw me out of a Skid Row mission early in the morning, and said, and stay out of here, you damn bum. And I lost it. Yeah, funny, huh? Wait till I get to the part where I die of leukemia. You like that? But this is in Los Angeles on a cold, rainy morning. I didn't know anybody in Los Angeles. He threw me, stay out of here. My dad would explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old LCD Elmeraz for the Borden Company. But the cows were running that very week in magazines and Life and Time and Telegram Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for one of their achievements? But it's kind of hard to explain these things in midair. You know? And I stood outside that damn old mission on that cold, rainy morning, wintertime, end of October. And I just couldn't believe it. I remember having a terrible feeling. I couldn't identify what it was, so I heard somebody else describe their feeling some years later. I thought that was it. I'm sure some of us had this feeling. You have to be on Skid Row to have it. You could be in, I've seen people have it in very posh homes. But the feeling of there is no friendly direction. There's no direction where if I pursue it far enough, there's going to be somebody glad to see me. You have just burned them all off. And I couldn't believe it. I'm too smart for this to have happened to me. I bet you I'm dreaming. In a minute now, my wife's going to shake my arm and say, Clancy, God, you've picked up all your covers. Get up and go to work. But it wasn't a dream. I stood there and I just, light rain falling, cold, sick. I just stunned. If some old guy would come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes now. You lost all your clothes. All your clothes, probably lost them in Phoenix, Arizona. Just before that cop arrested you, they took you to jail where that guy kicked your front teeth out. And I know that happened because my gums were bleeding and my lips were swollen up. He said, if you said you're an only child, and you're not even allowed to call your mother anymore in Wisconsin because your stepfather's so tired watching you manipulate her to get a few more bucks, or again, promise her some new promises, and then break her heart. He would rather have her think you were dead than to keep breaking her heart on the installment plan. Now, you've been going to AA off and on for almost 10 years, and you've been going steadily down, and you're dying. Why don't you, for God's sakes, go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and do something about it before you die? And if some guy had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or may not have been, because when you're desperate, honesty is just something that you use very often, I'd had to tell him, pal, it isn't the way it looks. I'm not an alcoholic. And I would have meant it. And I would have said, don't misunderstand me. I know there's something wrong with me. I know since I was a little boy. There's some stuff missing in me. There's something that makes me different. I'm not quite enough ever. See, people don't seem to accept me very well. I don't get along well with people a lot of times. I don't fit in a lot. And I really have never been very comfortable in my skin. And I've spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to find out why I'm not successful. And I've read books and I've done a lot of things. I've traveled, changed jobs, gone to cities and states. When I was 15 years old, nervous and irritable, and the Second World War had just started for us, one day I told my mother I was going to go to Superior, Wisconsin, and visit my aunt. She gave me a bus fare and packed my little bag, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. And I got a ride. I was so dumb, I don't know how in the world I ever made it. I had never been anywhere. I hadn't even been to Minneapolis, you know. And I asked the guy how to hitchhike. He said, just stand alongside the road. And I stood outside of Minneapolis. The car stops. Where are you going, kid? San Francisco. Says, go ahead, tell my hop in. And away we went. And he was in the Navy, apparently, going back to his ship. And I guess he wanted a lower companion to talk to. I don't know if they had any on the court. I was short, had a face full of pimples and dumb. And there were no motels there. We'd stop, there'd be a travel court. He'd get me a bed, bought my meals, and just listened to my crap all the way. You know, I thought about that many times. What a miracle that was. If he had dropped me off in Wyoming or something, I'd have been dead, I suppose. But I just thought that's the way it goes when you hitchhike. You tell people where you're going and they take you there. I told him I wanted to be in the Marine Corps and go kill jacks. He said, oh, kid, you're a little young, you're a little small. Probably can't get in. He said, what they're doing, they're really crying for merchant seamen right now. I'll kill you at the Coast Guard office. And tell them you're 16. Tell them you want to be a merchant seaman. See if they do. So he dropped me into San Francisco, and I went up to this public place, and said, I want to be a merchant seaman. Right, here's an application. I filled it up, put in 16s. Well, you're only 16, kid. You'll have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And they were really crying for seamen in those days. Most of the good guys got in the Navy. They just gave me seamen's papers temporarily, gave me permanent ones later. Sent me down to the National Maritime Union. I was down there, a big seagoing union. Had me sign a waiver for my union dues. And the guy carried me. I'm giving her a pass, but don't be the next one. The guy gave me a ride over to the ship, but that afternoon I was on a ship going to the South Pacific. And, it was kind of fun for a while. You know, there's an island there. That's where World's Fair was last year, Treasure Island. Mm-hmm. That's Alcatraz. Mm-hmm. There's the bridge. But the damn ship just kept going. Pretty soon the earth was going out of sight, and I was standing in my suitcase. And I think I had an intuitive feeling that I'd made the first in an endless series of career mistakes. So I said, get your forecastle. I know what a forecastle was. It sounded ominous to me. Turns out that's just a room where sailors live in a ship, seamen. And I was in there with three of the worst type of guys that a small, skinny, Norwegian, Lutheran, clean-cut kid could be with. These kind of people are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be, kid? I realized now why they're upset. I was the fourth man of their four-man deck watch, and they realized they'd just been screwed. I was going to do nothing for the rest of that trip. But everybody, I said, I saw the little tension, so I told them a couple jokes that used to go over big in study hall, and they didn't like them. Get your bunk. Remember, we got bunks. Still remember that ship moving, and the room was hot, and I didn't feel good, and I wanted my mother. I didn't want to say anything and ruin my image. And these guys got talking over here, and I had never heard talking yet. I mean, I thought I was restless, but I was raised in a strict church, boy, I'll tell you. And these guys got talking about what they'd been doing the 3 days. I only been in San Francisco 5 hours. They'd been there for 3 days, and they had been doing a lot of dirty things. And they had, they were some kind of... I realized that. I looked. They've got black hair. Those must be those Catholics I've heard about. I'd never seen any close up, really. And I don't give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people, if you could imagine such a thing as that. And I just felt terrible. And on that ship a little while later, these guys took a whiskey bottle out of their sea bag. We were supposed to have it. Poor hunchback little children. Anyway, go ring those bells. Anyway, the guys took out, and they drank whiskey. I remember one couple. I sat there, and one guy said, "How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And he shoved that bottle in my face, and that really offended me, because I may be dumb, but I'm a Lutheran, and Lutherans don't drink whiskey. And I just asked some guy like that intimidated, I could just feel my pimples stand up, are you? And I'm just getting ready to tell him, "How dare you put that in my face, you rotten person. I happen to be a Lutheran, and we don't drink whiskey. You put that bottle away. You just get away from me." I was about to just tell him that. And he said, "Well, how about it? You think you're man enough?" And I heard a voice say, "Goddamn right." I had my first drink out of the first bottle. I was close to death. Threw it up, and they laughed at me and ridiculed me. To this day, I don't know many feelings that are worse than public ridicule when you feel inadequate. I thought later, if I had a gun, I'd have shot them. I didn't dare hit them. They're all big. I thought something later, about a week later, I thought, I could have done this. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard. It would have been, "Hey, you, lean over.
Yeah.
Take that." But all the way across the Central Pacific where nobody was looking, I was sneaking that guy's sea bag every day. Take a drink of that, and it made me sick, and threw it up. Have to wipe it up so they didn't know I'd done it. But I wanted so desperately for those people to accept me. I just hated this stuff. I wanted to accept me. They were just coming to Pearl Harbor. They were still digging up ships off the bottom. And I was down there taking another drink of that. And I remember that the day before my 16th birthday. God, if I'm going to be 73, that's a long time ago. And I held a drink of whiskey down. And I hated it. It was just terrible. But then something strange happened. All of a sudden, I felt significantly better. And I realized why people drink whiskey. They don't drink it for the taste. They drink because it makes you feel better. And I didn't think much about it. When you're in your teens, that's when you learn things. On that ship, I learned to smoke. Nobody in my family smoked. They all smoked. So I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. But one day I smoked and didn't puke. And I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. Until I realized I was going bald. I learned to lust effectively. I learned all sorts of things. I didn't think much about it. I remember that a couple of days after that, we were in Pearl Harbor. And they took me to Honolulu and got me drunk on beer. And they all thought that was funny. And I became a raging alcoholic. I was just a dumb kid. I finally found a good role on that ship that sort of fit me well. I became the ship fool. "Hey, kid, go down the engine room. Tell them we need a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease." So at the end of that tour, I was doing a little bit better, and I got another ship going up to the Aleutians. We were just taking back the Aleutian Islands from the Japanese. And when I was 17, I went in the Navy. At the end of the war, the Naval Hospital up in Northern California being sewed together, they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests because I read a lot. I test well. I don't perform well, but I test well. And so they gave me a high school diploma from the Armed Forces Institute. So I'm still a junior in high school in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So I went back and went to the college after the war. The first must be a children's crusade going through here. The Holy Land is that way. Wonderful to see so many that you've allowed so many little orphan children to come here today. I went back to college, started college after the war, for the returning veterans. I'm sure it's the same way in Canada as with the United States. Never, most of you won't have any memory of it if you weren't old enough. But the fall of 1946 is a remarkable thing. Millions of people all got out of the service at once. They all had the GI Bill to go to school if they wanted to. So a lot of guys went to college, didn't even want to go to college. If there's something to do, they get paid for it. And schools had to hire buildings and rent new buildings. And it just, and it really, you know, really wild. You'd sit in freshman English class, and there'd be some ex-Marine Corps sergeant sitting there next to some little girl just out of Plum Run High School or something. Were you in the war? Yeah, you put out. Culture shock. But some of them did. I married one of them. And I went out in the world. I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, which to this day is still my favorite job. This girl I met in college, she had coal black hair and black flashing eyes. I'd never seen anything so exotic. And she won my heart. Then after she won my heart, she dropped a bomb on me. I'm a Catholic. And got it. I tried to fight against it. But she had me. We got married. My grandmother went into a depression for about 2 years. Not in the world. We got along well. But then I had this good job writing sports. Then my daughter, my wife, manifested this terrible, terrible situation that Catholic women do. And something no Lutheran boy knows anything about. And by the time you find out, it's too late. But I'll tell you this, if you're a Lutheran boy in this crowd, if you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to have a big family, whether you plan on one or want one. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just I used to pray to her and say, can't we use birth control? No. And if you're young, you will hardly believe this, but in those days, nobody ever mentioned condoms. I know, you know, I maybe heard it once in a Navy training club, but nobody ever talked. That was dirty, filthy stuff, you know. What you'd see once in a while, you'd see some kind of a depraved guy come by and say things like, I got a rubber. And even they would not dare go to the drugstore and buy them. They'd have to hire the absolute scum of the earth. And these guys would be ashamed, you know. Hey, give me some cigarettes.
That's a number.
And it's sure all different now. At least the drugstore over my house, these kids can say, hey, give me some condoms.
And some cigarettes.
I began having kids and all. I had to get better jobs, higher paying jobs. I worked in advertising and public relations, worked around the country here and there. And all these years I continued to drink. And I loved drinking. And I loved smoking. And I loved lusting effectively. I loved all the things that went with it. And we all were veterans and hardened. And my problem is sometimes I drank too much. As I like to think, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. They have a tendency to think I act bizarre. So I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. I don't know what they said in those meetings. On the way over here, we're talking. Glenn's not quoting that about that. I went to a meeting. These old guys sitting there on our drying and our stop drinking, put the plug in the jug. That's not me, baby. You know, you're an old burned out fool, 40 years old. Your life is over. And that didn't have any effect on me. And I went to AA off and on from then on. When the heat was on, I drank too much because nobody knew much about AA then. And you could, you know, there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. At the moment, say, you know, Charlotte, I guess I've been drinking a little bit too much lately. I'm going to go back to that A&A. Oh, wonderful. Maybe they'll do it this time. Sure they will, honey. They told me they want me to take her off. And she had no way to find out differently. He had a chance to live, but since the introduction of Al-Anon, there's never a moment's rest for anybody. No, they don't. She's supposed to stop it early. I know that. I'm I was 22 years old when I went to AA, which was the youngest in that whole part of the country. Today there's a lot of young people. We're talking about this afternoon, our charming Al-Anon speaker talking about the young people. And 22, I just felt I couldn't be an alcoholic. And today there's so many young people. My home group in Los Angeles, a big group, largest group in the world, I guess 1,000 people or more every Wednesday night. Some of you have been there. But we have a lot of young people. And I want to tell you young people who are here tonight, to this afternoon, but if anybody's told you this, but if you're like the young people in our group, you are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And I'll tell you something else. If you're like the young people in our group, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. Coming, Bill and Dr. Bob. And I went to AA off and on, and I drank, and I went to a psychiatrist to find out a lot about what caused my emotions, because I had a lot of emotions, fear, and had a lot of inadequacy and despair. I didn't fit in. And they say you shouldn't go to alcohol, they shouldn't go to psychiatry. I loved it. I found out ways I'd been hurt I never even dreamed of. I used to others think, it's no wonder I drink, for Christ's sake, I've been treated badly, you know. And I remember thinking, how good it is. I'm finding out what's causing these things all my life, these feelings. It took me a long time to realize I still have them. I just knew why now. Yeah. The only use of the information I can think of, maybe later tonight some guy in the bar comes and says, hey, what the hell's wrong with you? Then you can tell him. I was repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and I'm, shut up, you know. But the thing that always helped me the most was a few drinks. And I don't drink, because I'm a drinker. I drink is when I don't drink. I stop drinking many times. It's almost as though I would have described it this way that I could not have seen it, but I can see it in retrospect. I stayed drinking for a little while, and one morning, one night, somebody comes and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day, they start pushing that spring a little bit, and I get a little more irritable, a little more tense, a little more restless. And when you're a young guy, it's kind of fun, you know, you're drinking. You can say, okay, I'm a little jammed now, I'm going to go in the wagon. I'm going to lay off it for a while. And eventually the spring comes, you give it a couple of days, you say, well, okay, I did it, I'm off it. But when you get older, you get the jam. Because now when you stop drinking, you got to start promising people. You got to start promising the judge, or promising your family, or promising your employer, or promising your lover, or promising somebody. And now you stop drinking, and it gets hot and irritable and cross. And now you can't drink. You can't drink. You gotta. And it isn't even the drinking, it's the way these people are screwing me around. And the feelings come back, and the inadequacies, and despair, and resentments, and problems. And a guy in the fifth step years ago told me what he did in such a situation. And I suddenly realized that's what I did. And I never realized it once. What he did without being aware of it, he discovered it before I did. He would set up a beef with the person he had promised and got him in an argument or a fight. And then so he's able to say, oh, to hell with you. I stopped drinking for you. That's the way you are. To hell with you. I'll drink. And I've done that a lot of times with my wife or somebody else. Okay. I try to be nice. God damn it. You act like that. To hell with you. Why not drink? I never realized that I was drinking. I had to find a reason to drink. And I drink too much sometimes. And well-meaning people thought I was drinking too much. I go back to AA and hear that crap again about going to God. God's going to make it better. When you're a Norwegian Lutheran and you're a sinner, you know God isn't going to make it better. He's going to make it worse. I remember when I was new telling my sponsor, what chances are there for me? I've broken all 10 commandments. In my church, you break three and you're a goner. And I've broken all 10 of them. And a couple years later, I realized, in looking over my life, I haven't broken all. I never coveted my neighbor's manservant. It's a beachhead. What do you want? But I knew that there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what it was. I know that alcohol made it better. If I could, some way I could not drink so much, I'd be all right. And I guess I was going downhill for a lot of years. I didn't realize. I felt I was holding my own. I didn't have some victories. But one day off in a drunk, my wife took the children and left. I lost my job. Shortly after, they repossessed my car, and evicted from my house in Dallas, and had to get out of Dallas, got to Phoenix, where a guy arrested me, kicked my teeth out, went to Los Angeles, standing outside of a rain, mission in the rain, and 10 even, what the hell has happened to my life? But no old guy came over and talked to me that morning. I just, I've been to so many AA off and on during years, though I knew that sometimes AAs, you can tell them a sad story. They mean well. They're dumb, but they mean well. So I found out where an AA club was at some Wilshire and Fairfax, where the hell that was. He said, you just go west out of Wilshire. I didn't know anybody in Los Angeles. And I walked and walked. And later on, I counted my car some years later. It was 72 long blocks. That's a long way to walk when you're sick and desperate and bleeding. And a woman in New York asked me one time, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so desperate? And of course, the answer is simple. That's the only time you can. You could do it no other time. But if you're desperate enough, you'll do what you got to do. And I got to this stupid club. Same old fanatic, same old crap on the wall. Keep coming back, live another, turn it over to God, work the step. I know nothing more depressing to an intelligent non-alcoholic than to be faced by that kind of crap. Especially if you got a hangover, I'll tell you that. But I hung around that club and that night they had a meeting. I had to stay out of the rain and I ate about 4 pounds of cake and listened to somebody talk about gratitude and I almost puked it up again. And I had no place to sleep. The guy said, the back of the parking lot there, there's an old 49 Merc. I left there last summer sleeping out. Oh, Jesus, that's really wonderful. Thanks a lot. I slept in that morning, a Sunday morning, having a spiritual meeting, talking about God or Jesus or somebody I didn't like. And I had 4 pounds of cake and sat around and ducked and lurked and kept raining that night. There was a meeting again. I had some more cake and listened to this crap and slept in the abandoned car that night, got up in the morning. I really remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is hell. Maybe this, my grandmother was right. This is what you get when you marry a Catholic. Just billions of years of eating cake and living in an abandoned car and listening to people talk about AA. Okay? And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety day. I didn't intend for it to be. Didn't want it to be my sobriety day. I tell you, I've had sobriety days where I really quit. You know, we're talking about earlier about that type of alcoholic. If it's bad enough, he can quit. I had a reason that good. I was out drunk one night. I've been in jail a lot. Not so much I'm a big felon or tough, but I have a tendency, it took me years and sobriety to overcome it, but when I get drunk, I have a tendency to challenge and direct police officers. You would think you'd learn after a while, but I... Hey, listen, you son of a bitch, you can... But I was in jail one night, and that was the wrong night. That night my son died, and I was in jail. And I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and it just about killed me. They came down and told me, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your little boy died. Oh, God. And I remember sitting around that Sunday before the funeral on Monday, and my brothers-in-law came, and my father-in-law, and we sat around the living room. Nobody said an unkind word to me. Not an unkind word. You want some more coffee, Clancy, or something? But you just see in their eyes, you dirty, rotten bastard. You dirty, rotten. What have you done to our sister? You dirty. And I just smiled. Next day, we buried a little boy, and I put my hand in his casket. I said, John Immeslin, this will never happen again. Your dad promises you that. And I went back to work. I was working in Texas then, and boy, I almost had a feeling of, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry my son died, but at least it's for a purpose. It's for the other children, for his mother. Maybe he just sent here as kind of to give his life for him, so I would do something. And I just felt, I'll never drink again. My dad said, every time you go by a bar, you ought to see John's face on the door. I said, you bet, Dad. No worry about that. And he wondered if you can stop drinking. You bet you can. For a while. But one morning I got up after a while and there was that spring in my gut. And then it just started to get a little bit worse every day. Now I'm irritable and cross and upset, but now it's a self-pity. I've lost my little boy. They want me to act like some kind of idiot. What the hell is... And the job I liked, they didn't like, and the daughters I was doing it for, their noise made me bother. Mary, take your sister and get out of here. Go to your room. Daddy will pay you to her. I'm sorry. Jeez. You know, everybody just... And I knew if I could just take 2 or 3 drinks, I could ease off. But you take a bomb in your son's casket, you can't do that. So one day, I just was crazy. My wife took the children to mass, and I pulled the car in the garage and hooked up the hose in the exhaust pipe and turned the motor, went to sleep and died. I didn't know what to do. And a neighbor had just happened to be watching us out the window and noticed me going there, heard the motor running. And I didn't come out, and he ambled over and found me dead in the car. And he pulled me out and they beat it in my chest and they breathed in my mouth and rushed me to the hospital and examined me at length and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period. Nothing on my commitment papers said alcohol. It said schizophrenic, paranoid tendencies. And I, now that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That's not your basic alcohol problem, I wouldn't call it. And I, stopping drinking doesn't help me. I'll tell you how I actually got out of there, because the next year, a number of months later, they put in an experimental alcoholic ward in that hospital run by alcoholic AA members. And I gave them such a story, I finally got out as a recovered alcoholic. And I never had another drink till I ran out of Thorazine. But it was a bad, bad place. I thought, you know, here I look back and think, why would I couldn't stay sober there. Why would I stay sober this time when there was absolutely no reason to stay sober? I'll tell you, as best I can say it, you know, there are authorities in AA. There really shouldn't be, but there are. And I'll tell you who authorities are. Authorities are people who come from a long ways away. If you have a convention in Edmonton or out in Calgary, they bring in speakers from New York and Florida because they're authorities. When they have conventions in California, they do the same thing. When they have conventions in New York, they bring speakers in from California and Canada. They bring in Florida. I'm kind of an authority in Toronto. I go there every February. In the morning, I talk on something like the history of AA or the traditions or the steps or something. In the afternoon, you have a question and answer meeting. And at night, I tell my story. I've been doing that for years. I'm somewhat of an authority there. A few years ago, and I'll tell you one thing. I really like the question and answer meeting because I've discovered I have a facility to weave a tapestry of verbal BS while I think of the answer. A few years ago, I was over there talking. This woman in the back said, "Hi, T. I have a question. If you don't mind, I wouldn't like one of your long answers." Somebody ought to slap that bitch. I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. Which is every year we hear forever about how long you stuck, how long you slipped, and how terrible it was. And then how long you've been sober, how wonderful you are. What happened? What was it? In a sentence or two, could you just tell us what was the difference? And I could not think of an answer in a sentence. I thought, ma'am, I'm sorry. A little too complex for a sentence or two. Don't misunderstand me. You know, it's really quite a complex thing, and I want to go back and snatch her ball. She threw off my rhythm. That night I was taking a shower right before the meeting, and an answer came. And the answer came, at least it seemed to be the right answer, but I didn't like it because it said nothing answer. I hate nothing answers. I want answers with a little body, a little panache. We have some new people in this room this afternoon. I hope when they leave here they'll say things like, "Did you hear what Clancy said?" "Did you hear what Clancy told us? Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon." These answers mean nothing but to give the newcomer hope. The answer I thought of, which I thought was a tawdry two-bit little answer, was this is the first time in all the years I'd been around AA that I felt so bad psychologically that I let people who weren't qualified to do so tell me what to do. Because I knew I was smarter than they are and better. And I didn't make any vow. I'm going to turn over my life to these people. I had to stay off the streets. It was cold, I was sick. The only place I had to go was this damn club. They had meetings there. And I let them order me around. It hurt my... For example, in those days, there weren't any styrofoam cups. Everybody had porcelain cups. That's all you ever had. Then at every meeting, somebody had to wash them. And you might say to me, "Are you boy there, in the front row without the front seat, you want to wash the cups today?" If I had anything left at all, I'd say, "No, I don't want to wash the cups today or tomorrow night or next week either. I should go screw yourself in your cup." I found myself saying, Going to help us clean up the room and put the chairs away? Come on early tomorrow night. Now you can set up. And it went on and I lived in that abandoned car, hung around that club, brown-nosed people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn. It was just terrible. I stayed sober, but it wasn't my fault. But then the next thing they do, they really, if you stay sober more than 10 minutes, it's time to get a sponsor. Better get a sponsor. I've had sponsors over the years. I've had a lot of sponsors. And if you're new to that, I want to tell you about getting a sponsor. These sponsors all seem very nice and kind. But pretty soon they'll all want to stick their nose in your business. I used to see this guy come to the club. He was a movie actor. He's a character actor. He wasn't a star, but he always played loving roles. He'd be giving people money or being kind to them. And I thought, this might be my sponsor. If I get to be my sponsor, maybe I get some dough. Maybe I can get some front teeth, get a suit, get in New York, get a good job. I can buy back someday and buy this club and burn the goddamn thing down. I just got to get going on. I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? It's a church, Ed, but I want you to know. I expect you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I want sobriety on an all-time basis. They like to hear that. I'll tell you, looking back now, I look at that guy. He should have won the Academy Award for every movie kindly role he ever played. Because they were foreign to his nature. He was a right-wing fascist AAP. I felt like Quasimodo. Now let me ring the bell, Bob. And he gave me some firm direction, gave me some crap. You know, I used to look back years ago and think, why would I take that crap from that guy? I didn't take crap from anybody, up or down. People start giving me crap, I don't take it. I've had big jobs, making big money, where somebody gave me just a little too much crap. And take your job and shove it! Get yourself another boy, I'm too smart to be hanging around you. I'd hum nights in bars, people would say, you don't seem so much to me. You don't think so, son of a bitch? You try me. And I get knocked on my can a lot, but they know I'm tough. Watch out for that skinny down there, kid. He's crazy down there. Wasn't all sober quite a while. I discovered, and again I heard a guy talk about it in his inventory to me, why I was so defiant. I'll tell you why. Because all my life, I guess, I secretly knew that I was a weakling. And I hate it. I despise being a weakling. And I am a weakling. I hate it. And I'll fight. I'll quit jobs. I'll do anything. No one's going to find out I'm a weakling. Ever. And I don't take crap from anybody. Kind of reminds me of that when I saw that movie Back to the Future with that kid there, all you had to do is call him Chicken and he would do whatever you threatened him to. That's why I thought about that later. I thought, isn't that funny in AA? Where I finally was driven down so hard to take crap. And eventually here, by taking these actions, I eventually became strong. And now I can afford to be weak. But I couldn't afford to be weak when I was weak. I had to be strong. But little by little, he gave me actions. He had me do things. And he didn't have much understanding of sensitive, intelligent people. I said, Bob, I'm living in this abandoned car, Bob. You know, I got these old clothes and people buy me food once in a while, but they treat me like a piece of crap. You know, I'm not used to this. I'm an intelligent, productive man, Bob. I can't live like this. What should I do?
Get a job!
Get a job, for Christ's sake. Look how terrible I look.
So get a terrible job.
Well, I did that. I had a couple jobs. I got fired. And I was a guy that let me sleep on the sofa. I stayed there for a while. And then his wife got mad because I was putting cigarettes out under the sofa. But the ashtray was on the other side of the room. It wasn't my fault. And another guy had me stay in his apartment until his girlfriend came over one night. He wanted me to take a walk on the streets for 3 hours while he counseled her. I suggested that she walk on the streets. She was more used to it than I was. And so I was 6 months sober and I was back in that abandoned car again. Jesus. A guy put in some cop, got me a job as a dishwasher, and I got fired on the second day. And I had the feeling things are not working out. And I decided to do it. I didn't get sick. I decided to kill myself. I didn't have any cardio to turn on and go to sleep, but I wasn't kind of dramatic. I'd seen a movie called A Star Is Born. At the end of that, this guy, misunderstood drunken person, walks in the ocean, finding they're all very sorry, but it's too late then. So I walked back down to La Siena, got over to Wilshire, started out in Wilshire to the ocean. Tears of self-pity in my eyes. I couldn't find the damn ocean. I stopped at the gas station. I said, where's the ocean? He said, you said Western Beverly Hills, kid. You have to go out past the Veterans Hospital about another 4 miles after that. I said, oh, screw that. I'll call my sponsor, but he would give me a ration of crap. But I tell him I've been fired, because he hates when I get fired. I used to be an award-winning writer. Stuff I wrote is still running in magazines. I will tell him a story that is so beautiful and so sad that even that hard-hearted puke will be touched. And he'll come out and say, here's some money. I misunderstood you, son. I said, Bob, this is Clancy. Why aren't you working, Bob? Let me explain this. You know, I've lost my family. I'll never see them again. I know that. I can accept that. I've lost my career. I know that. All the things like that have happened to me. I can understand. But there's some things you don't know, Bob. Even in AA, where you say it's going to be wonderful for me, you come to the meeting once a week and you go to other meetings. But I'm down here all the time. And these people, they know there's something wrong with me, I guess, Bob, because they treat me badly. They won't call on me in meetings. They called me once and never call on me again. They old-timers tell their newcomers to stay away from me. Old-timers tell their newcomer girls to stay a long way from me. I go to the club and sit down and have a cup of coffee, and people get up and go to a different table, Bob. AA may be for everybody, but AA isn't for me, because even in AA they think I'm just terrible. And it suddenly struck me, this is all true. And I burst into tears. It's the saddest day. What am I going to do, Bob? He said, why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you? And I just told him the week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist, high paid price guy. Why do you want to take it with some out of work actor? What's he going to do? Cut, we'll do it again. Yeah, that's cute. I said, Bob, in my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need. My God, I'm so full of remorse and regret to go over that again and write down all that stuff again just to punish myself. Bob, in my judgment, I need something much more deep and much more fulfilling. And he explained that to me. He said, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in the back seat of an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. You're a loser. You're a loser. How do you get me upset? You know that parking lot? Good thing I turned left. I turned around and been in the ocean, boy. I got to the club. I said, Solomon, give me some paper. Where's my inventory? Give me a pat. I was so upset I put down things in which I wasn't the hero. Just terrible. Rock, terrible. Guy told me one time, all those things you never told a soul, you put that in. Why don't you tell that to your psychiatrist? Of course, the answer is quite simple. When you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you don't tell your psychiatrist. You did what, sir? Get out of my office. The first wash off that chair. And I finished this terrible thing, just dirty, filthy. I stepped into the backseat of that car and I forgot about it, got a little better. And then a couple days later, he goes, what a time to take your fifth step. I don't think I want to do that, Bob. Shut up, get in the car. So he gave me a flashlight and he drove from Santa Monica to Oxnard, and I read this thing. Oh, and read worse than I'd remembered it. It's dirty. I knew that he thought I was a terrible person. I'd done terrible. It's nasty. He's going to make me walk all the way back to Oxnard, 40 miles. I get down. That's all, Bob.
So you're done now?
Yeah. He reached over and said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. But I've taken that same trip over 200 times since then. On the driver's side, with some other puke over there with a flashlight. Let me explain this part before I read it. Now, I've heard a lot of inventories. I'll tell you something strange. All good inventories, in my opinion, are the same. They're all the same. They vary all over specifics and backgrounds, ups and downs, and psychological insights. But they all contain certain things. lack of self-worth, a lot of guilt, fear, tremendous resentments, and occasional lashing out at the world to punish them for what you've done to me. A few years ago, I listened in 1 week, a daughter of one of the most famous men of the 20th century, and a couple days later, a guy just out of the Washington State Penitentiary. Same inventory, completely different specifics. And it's that way all over. That's what makes A such a remarkable thing. It works at a level that you can't see it working. That's why you have to take it and do it despite what your opinion of it is. You can't trust your judgment. As a guy said, in the last few years, I've been very active. And I've been asked to come and speak a lot of funny places. The last few years, I've been down in Cape Town, South Africa, and Johannesburg. And last year, I was in Oslo and Belfast. And I've been in Paris and Berlin and Dublin and Easter Island down in Australia and a lot of places, all over in every province in Canada, every state in the United States, and actually a lot of places. You'd think you'd really find exotic AA in some of these places, but you really don't. Except for the accents, you hear the same feelings that you hear in your group right here. Same emotions, same feelings. It almost seems like all over the world, every group almost devolves down to the same basic pattern. In every group, there's some people who have come here feeling bad, feeling they don't fit, feeling their case is different. For some reason or other, have taken the actions of AA, and now they're feeling better, and they come to AA on a regular basis, and they sit in these meetings, and they look for newcomers. In every group, there seems to be some people who will not or cannot take these actions, and they sit and criticize those that do, and ridicule them sometimes, and smirk and sneer. And then there's the new people. And both of these groups fight for their souls. And it's amazing we keep as many as we do, because the arguments against AA are intellectually more satisfying than the arguments for it. And that's why it's so important to think that it's nice when people are desperate when they come here. They maybe surrender some of their judgment as what should be done. But little by little, over a period of time, AA begins to take hold. And the nice thing about it is you don't have to take your actions because you want to or because you think they're good. Neither the steps nor the actions care who take them or why you take them. But it's almost as though, as you do it, you start to change. A great example of that, I don't want to talk too long, but a great example of that, in the 1700s, the most lethal illness in the world was smallpox. When you got a smallpox epidemic, just people died. They had no idea what germs were, had no idea what bacteria were. Just you got sick. Some of the people thought it was caused by the moon. Just like the beginning of AIDS. Maybe it was caused by a evil doing or what. Didn't know what it was. And when the epidemic hit, I have a book home called Bring Out Your Dead about Philadelphia in the early 1700s. You go through the town, just wagons every day. You bring out your mother, you bring out your children, your dead children, and throw them on the wagon and hope you didn't catch it. That's all you know. And nobody could find an answer for it. And in England, there was a young doctor named Edward Jenner. And he was very concerned about these people. He couldn't find the answer. But he noticed something strange. He stumbled on the fact that girls who milk cows didn't get smallpox. Now, what the hell would that be about? So he studied them for a while. And then there were some girls who milk cows who did get smallpox. But there's another group that didn't. And he discovered they all had something called cowpox, which was a mild disease. These girls had a type that didn't seem to protect them. These girls had a type that did protect them in some way. They didn't know why, no knowledge of disease or germs. So he decided to make one of the great classic medical experiments. He bought a little boy named Jimmy Phipps. You could buy little boys then for 9 years old. And he took them to where these girls had the cowpox. And he didn't know how this worked, but he cut a little slash in the kid's arm, took some pus off her eyes, and rubbed it in the wound. And the kid got cowpox. And then he got better. And then he took him over where they were dying of smallpox, and made a little cut in his arm. He didn't touch it with his hands this time, took a stick, took the pus and blood off the guy, and rubbed it in the kid's arm. And the kid got very sick, and got better. And that's the first time they ever knew how to stop smallpox. You give them cowpox, that type of cowpox. Nobody knew why. A lot of people didn't go for it. Interesting thing, the word for cow in Latin is vacus. The word vaccination means injection of the cow to this day. But of course, there's much more than that now. But most people would not accept it. I'm not going to have cowpox. What's that got to do with smallpox? So a lot of them kept dying, but some of them didn't. They took the cowpox and survived. And about 150 years later, they finally discovered why it worked. When they discovered germs and bacteria, they discovered that cowpox, this particular ailment, has the ability to set up antibodies that hold off the smallpox virus. And it's very successful ever since. It's almost wiped out in the world now. And in much the same way as with AA sometimes. I got a feeling someday, 100 years from now, some crazed social scientist will come out of his laboratory and say, I've got the answer. It turns out that a series of apparently non-applicable actions taken under the direction of a crazed dictator sets up a series of coordinates in the mind almost that makes the top of the cerebral cortex not subject to the depressions and need for alcohol. And people say, that's right, doctor. Oh, God, we're going to give won't do us any good. We'll all be dead. It'll make them feel better. So we're almost in the same position, if you're new tonight, at this pig roast or any other meeting that Dr. Jenner was. All we can tell you is, we don't care how you what you think about it, take the cowpox. Take the cowpox. The cowpox here is meetings and sponsorship and eventually taking actions whether or not you believe in them. And that's exactly the name of the game here. Take the cowpox, and little by little you stay better. In the world today, there are a couple million sober alcoholics. 65 years ago, there were two. That's kind of a big change because of this organization. And I eventually stayed sober. I didn't do very well because I have a smart mouth and I fought against a lot of the therapies, but eventually I got a little place to live and got a little job and I got another little job. I was 2 years sober. I got a little job as a writer in the medical corporation. And I had some money put aside, and I said to my sponsor, I said, Bob, I have some money, I'm going to get some front teeth, I'm going to make my move. He says, you got money put aside? Send that to your kids in Dallas. I said, Jesus, Bob, I send them money. They've all got front teeth. I need the front teeth, Bob. He says, they got a crappy diet too. Send my money. So I was working this medical corporation, but I learned to carry my lip like this. Nobody knew I didn't have front teeth. My sponsor insists I go to work every day. That's a new concept. And I'll tell you, I learned some great lessons about spirituality working on that job. Do you want to hear some great spiritual lessons? I'm sure old timers know this, maybe newcomers don't. You've heard of the spiritual concepts of prayer and meditation? Yeah, they are. But let me tell you some more. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not going to be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Children, waiters and waitresses, employees. On days you know you're having a bad day, watch that damn mouth. Because you can just cut people to ribbons and ruin relationships and never have the slightest idea what happened. And on. And I never learned these lessons well, but I learned them well enough to... I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that medical corporation. I had front teeth and I smiled at the drop of a hat. Now, 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood and we created something called Boss Radio. We became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? Made you want to puke. When I was 10 years sober, downtown thing, public relations oil companies. 15 years sober, as a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic up the street. Thank God somebody bought me a metronome, and I got the old rhythm system. It beats coitus interruptus, or whatever they call it. Now they're all grown up. Well, I was at the convention last week with three of my daughters. They're all turning 11 this year in AA. Don't. Take up a love offering. I'll see if they get it. Oh. the rest of my kids aren't alcoholics. Only one of my daughters has turned out bad. I'm sorry to report. She's become a district attorney. We'd so hope she'd be a public defender, but no. A couple years ago, she's home for Christmas. She said, remember, Dad, when we were little girls, you used to send us to a little room. We have to go to our room. I said, sure. She says, when you come to Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm going to send you to a little room. Haven't been by there lately. Isn't that a nice story? It's all very nice, all very true. Same wife and I have been married for 51 years now. She knows this is her last chance. But I want to, all of this is, I want to, this is the introduction. I want to give you just a 5-minute talk. I'm going to sit down. This is what you call your long introduction. Now, this is just a short talk to the newcomer. The one thing I've said today, you may have not heard, thought about, you might think about it later. I got a fear said my name is Clancy Imbeslet. I'm an alcoholic. When did I become an alcoholic? My problem never was alcohol. How in the world was I an alcoholic? I'm so glad that I stayed around here in desperation. Because of course, you're not scared we were in desperation, but I've had to watch that same desperation, guys, still making $1 million a year, just absolutely lost. Long enough to take action so that I could stay here to survive, to hear something I never dreamed of. I could not be an alcoholic, I always knew, because my problem really isn't alcohol. Imagine staying in AA long enough to discover that if my problem is alcohol, I'm not an alcoholic. Now, doesn't that sound spooky? But that's basically the truth. You might say, what, the problem is alcohol? Everybody knows that. I could disprove that in 5 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. They don't. Jails, hospitals. They turn out sober people with varying amounts of information. But I'll guarantee if they be like my type, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later, they must always eventually drink or sedate. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what is it? Is it something spooky they're not telling us? No. Everyone in the room, every new person knows exactly what's wrong with them. They don't know what it is. Tell you what it is. It's something called alcoholism. You hear a lot about that. Alcoholism. Alcohol, same thing, isn't it? Not at all. We could talk about that for 2 hours. We'll put it in one sentence because we want to get out of here. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act and not drinking anymore. In this strange thing called alcoholism, which to the naked eye, unfortunately for you and I, looks exactly the same, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That is what makes alcoholism a pain, a deadly disease, because the pain of sobriety gets worse than the remembered reason, recovery of drinking. And eventually it just gets so bad you can't stand it. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. One other thing must be present. You must be one of the 7 or 8%, nobody knows exactly how many, of people who drink, and it's always been this way, apparently as often as they can check, who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. So the question is, what is the unnatural reaction to alcohol? Make you stay drunk all the time, like these people say? No. Nobody can stay drunk all the time. Can't stay drunk 2 weeks. Makes you act crazy, you hear all these crazy stories on the nut halls and jails. That's all podium flash. You know what alcohol has to do to make you an alcoholic? It has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. Not what it does to you at all. If it doesn't do anything special for you, it never does anything special to you, because you'll quit. But if it does something special for you, you'll discover it almost instantly alters your perception of reality. It almost changes your relationship to the world around you. It almost instantly makes you taller, more self-contained, and smaller and less threatening. It changes things. And if it does that for you, you are a doomed person. Very strange, strange thing. Today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, thousands and thousands of meetings, all sorts of things, it is estimated that about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. Still die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. And they die convinced, but I'm not really an alcoholic because my problem really wasn't alcohol. It's all these other things. I just drank to get some relief, for God's sakes. And got a little out of hand. They don't realize they just define the disease of alcoholism. And that's why it's so lethal. Because you can go to your grave drinking and know it wasn't your fault at all. Look what they've done to me now. And that's why stopping drinking, with or without a solemn vow or all the determination, how good your reason. If you're an alcoholic of our type, all that just postpones it, pal. And you'll go down again, as I've gone down again, and countless people. In my work today, I do something that none of you do, I'm sure. I deal with people who are dying from alcoholism. Tomorrow morning, Monday morning, when I go to work, I've been there for 10 days, but tomorrow morning I go to work, I get out of my car and I step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office. And I go home at night and I step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office, to get to my car. And I think I know as much about, maybe about the perils of alcoholism as most. It's true, these are Skid Row people. But most of the people I sponsor. I've sponsored a lot of people over the years. Guys that put the flag on the moon. Guys that won the Emmys, the best director in Hollywood for the last 4 years. Guys that can't hold a job as a dishwasher. What have they all got in common? They didn't all get kicked out of the Midnight Mission with their teeth kicked out. They lived in a world where sobriety became untenable and now drinking was untenable. And they know that there's no way out. So I would say that this, if you're kind of new tonight, you better try taking the chicken pox. You better try, the cow pox. You better start taking the cow pox. Because it's just too deadly out there. The last thing I want to say, and I've already given it away, I suppose I've said it. When I was about 15 years sober, the tendency to take bad jobs hit me again. And I left a good job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 26 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you do that, for Christ's sake? Why would you give up this great career to that stinking mission? And I never have been able to think of a good answer. I think, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it must be spiritual. It's a funny thing, I wish, if you're new, you might think, that wonderful old man going to Skid Row every morning to help. I get in my car a lot of mornings, and my car doesn't want to go to Skid Row. My car wants to go to Beverly Hills into my office where there are pretty girls in tight sweaters saying, here's your coffee, Mr. Emerson, anything else? I don't want to go down there Monday and see who died since I've been gone, who smashed it into the sidewalk, who stabbed who. But I notice when I go home at night, I find something strange. I find myself feeling more of a man inside than I ever did going down all those elevators in Beverly Hills, popping my fingers and being slick. And I sleep very well, and I do well, and I'm able to get around. I was thinking of 73, my father could barely walk at 73, 2 weeks ago I was out pitching a doubleheader softball game. So, great. There's something there. I don't want to give you new people the wrong impression, however. Even if you go to meetings, even if you get a sponsor and take these actions and take these steps, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you'll have your own mission. There's only so many you go around. I got mine, and that's the reason. But I think we can guarantee you that you will walk with a degree of dignity. That the purpose of AA really is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to make you feel. When I was a boy, I wanted to feel the way men looked. And the best advice I can tell you about AA today, I eventually in AA came to find myself feeling the way men look. And I can live with some degree of kindness and love and without fear much of the time. I can afford to be weak when it's necessary, and I can afford to be strong. And that's why I continue to do it. I'm not a good guy. I'm a weak, humble, defiant person of myself. With AA, I'm a person I can live with. And if you're new, one more time I'll say it, then I won't say anymore. Take the damn old cowpox. Take the damn old cowpox. You'll be glad you did. Thank you.